Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This 26th day of June 2023. We have one case on our calendar for oral argument this morning. It is a case in which the case name is Smith v. State of Minnesota. I see that counsel is here for appellant Ryan Leroy Smith. The state did not file a brief in this matter, so they will not be presenting oral argument. We are ready for argument from Mr. Smith's attorney. Would you please introduce yourself for the record before you begin your argument? And the podium does raise and lower if it's the height's not to your liking. Take a moment to get situated and you may begin.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Van Berkum, and I am here on behalf of appellant Ryan Smith. This is a claim that arises under the Minnesota Imprisonment and Exoneration Remedies Act. It was a statute that was specifically enacted by the state of Minnesota to compensate individuals who spent time in prison and subsequently were exonerated. Exoneration is defined in subdivision 1 of MnStat section symbol 590.11. And it's undisputed that Mr. Smith meets the legal definition of exonerated, as this matter has been before the Court of Appeals once to address that issue, and the Court of Appeals confirmed that he did.
Yeah, let's stop there, because I think there are some questions for you.
Okay.
First, as I understand your primary argument, I think what you would call your strongest argument, it's that because there was a joint petition, exoneration is conclusively established and the district court had no choice but to find your client eligible for compensation. Is that a fair assessment?
That is our position.
And do you agree that that is an issue of law which we review de novo?
I do.
Then I have a question regarding statutory requirements as to that issue. In fact, the statute does provide a mechanism wherein the prosecutor can join a petition in the interest of justice, but the statute has certain requirements. That is, one, the prosecutor joins a petition, and two, the prosecutor indicates that it is likely that the original complaint or indictment would not have been filed or sought or would have been dismissed with knowledge of all the circumstances. I don't see that indication from the prosecutor anywhere in the court record. Does the absence of that indication render the attempt to submit a joint request under 590.11 subdivision 3A inadequate?
Our position that it clearly does not render it inadequate, and the reason we believe that is the case is, if you look at the joint petition, in paragraph 9, the parties specifically indicate that the prosecutor is joining it and no additional hearing is necessary, and then it references subdivision 3. And so clearly our position is that the prosecutor is incorporating by reference that statute and confirming that
if that's the case. If the prosecutor need only reference 590.11 subdivision 3, why would the legislature have written in this requirement about an indication on and on? I mean, we do have to apply and interpret statutes to give effect to all of the provisions, and that's a very specific provision, and yet you're arguing, well, we cited the statute, therefore we've complied. I don't see that as compliance, and if it's not necessary for the prosecutor to make such an indication, according to your theory, a reference is adequate, have we not read that requirement out of the statute?
Our position is that it wouldn't read it out of the statute, and the reason being, again, that the language in paragraph 9 specifically references that no additional hearing is necessary, so I believe that makes it clear that what the parties, including the prosecutor, are referring to is subdivision 3A, which includes
that language. I agree it's clear that that's what the prosecutor is referring to, but don't agree it's clear that the prosecutor was of the mind that the original complaint or indictment would not have been sought or would have been dismissed with knowledge of the full circumstances. Would it have been so hard for the prosecutor to simply say that?
No, certainly, Justice Larkin, in hindsight, it would be preferable to have that language in the petition, and there's no reason that it couldn't have been, I would submit that. Again, clearly the prosecutor agreed that this is a situation that the joint presumption exists, or the conclusive presumption, excuse me.
I hear what you're saying, but the fact that the prosecutor agreed isn't dispositive. We need to apply the law de novo and determine whether it's a circumstance where clearly compensation is available under the law. If we were to disagree that the joint petition was inadequate for failure to comply with that statutory requirement, what would your alternative argument be to support the claim that your client is exonerated within the meaning of the statute and entitled to compensation? And that's a trick question, because you have to answer that question in light of the Minnesota Supreme Court's recent decision in BAC, discussing its prior decision in Kingbird, which were cases issued by the Supreme Court after this court concluded, in its unpublished opinion in your client's case, that he was, in fact, exonerated on grounds of factual innocence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and our position is that even if the court were not inclined to apply the conclusive presumption, that does not mean Mr. Smith is not eligible for compensation. It simply means that you have to apply subdivision 3B instead of 3A. And as outlined, and we did argue in the alternative at the district court that led to this appeal and our trial memorandum.
I understand that, but circumstances have changed because the Supreme Court has issued two decisions, mm-hmm. Kingbird and BAC. BAC was a decision from May 24th after we had requested supplemental briefing in this case, so I know you didn't have the opportunity to brief the issue, but BAC seems to make pretty clear that the circumstances justifying a finding of factual innocence are limited to those where the facts have changed in the case. So how have the facts in this case changed that would bring it within the meaning of factual innocence as set forth by the Supreme Court in BAC in May?
Well, I think, again, if you look at the definition in the statute, which I believe remains the same.
Have you had an opportunity to read BAC?
Candidly, I have not.
Okay.
Justice.
Well, in BAC, the Supreme Court interpreted the meaning of actual innocence, mm-hmm. and essentially said that does not apply to cases where there's been a conviction reverse based on a legal determination, such as insufficient evidence, which is why your client's conviction was reversed. He was convicted of an offense, and there was no evidence regarding a specific element of that offense. And Kingbird said factual innocence does not encompass a situation where the appellate courts have interpreted an element of an offense in a way that would preclude conviction under the facts in a particular case. And both opinions talk about the fact that factual innocence is meant to encompass only those circumstances where the facts have changed. For example, Mr. Fong's case in St. Paul, where he was convicted of intentionally accelerating his car into another driver, which resulted in a tragic death. And they said, well, they thought it was intentional. It turns out later the facts change. His Toyota Camry was accelerating beyond his control. Another example they gave was a fellow who was convicted of homicide involving his young child, and it was later determined that the expert was wrong. The child had actually died of asphyxiation through no fault of the father. So those are the examples. The facts have changed. That's factual innocence. Okay, if you trust me that that's what the Supreme Court has said, and I appreciate that you haven't read the case, could you tell us how we would apply that meaning of factual innocence to this case and come to a conclusion that some facts have changed that would justify this court's earlier conclusion, which predated those cases, that there was a showing of factual innocence here?
Well, at the time of the conviction, and I'm going to argue that it could be viewed as a change in the facts, is that the prosecution was trying to use a prior conviction to enhance the sentence here. And what the court found later was that that was not proper. So in other words, that when you apply not the facts as viewed by the district court at the time of the trial, but later, that there is no third conviction that would allow them to enhance it. And I certainly think that can be viewed as a factual difference that would support a finding of factual innocence.
Except Back expressly says insufficient evidence to support the conviction is not factual innocence. And I think what you've just described is insufficient evidence to support the conviction. You need to have proof of a certain type of criminal vehicular operation prior to have justified your client's original conviction, and the proof wasn't there. And I've monopolized a lot of the time. Do other panel members have questions or wish to jump in?
Okay.
I don't.
Yeah, and I, my only other response I'd have is, I guess, again, if you look at subdivision one and apply the plain language of the statute and what happened to Ryan Smith in this case, that I believe he does meet the definition of exonerated based on an application of the statute and the statutory language.
So I do have one question. Didn't the state in this case seek to amend, change the count to a gross misdemeanor count? Because it seems like all we're dealing with here, the reversal was on the level, that there weren't actually three prior qualifying convictions to make it a felony.
And I would submit the import of like, for example, him being found guilty of or being charged with a gross misdemeanor, really where that would come into play under this statute is the calculation of the time of compensation. Because under subdivision 4 of 590.11, the statute says that you can deduct time that he would have served for the same behavioral incident. And so, for example, if you look at our Exhibit 1 to our primary brief, we do acknowledge that to the extent he had been required to serve time for a gross misdemeanor, that would disqualify him from compensation for that time period, but it does not disqualify him from compensation.
Right, but that would also, I mean, what I was looking, and I agree, and I understood that. You were made that clear in your brief. But on whether or not we ought to apply the automatic acknowledgement in A, if the state doesn't make clear in the petition, and in fact their conduct would undermine kind of us assuming that that's what they intended, because they in fact tried to add a gross misdemeanor count, then I mean, how does that factor into the automatic acceptance?
I believe that would be more important to a determination of the threshold exoneration determination, and I say that because if you look at subdivision 1 of 590.11, under subdivision 1B1, little I, it talks about exoneration means that you're exonerated, there's no remaining felonies, excuse me, from the same behavioral incident. So whether or not he was charged with or would have been convicted of a gross misdemeanor arising out of the same behavioral incident, that it's our position that would not disqualify him from compensation because it does not change his status as being exonerated because it's not a felony level. So once you determine that even if there was a gross misdemeanor, he's not disqualified from being exonerated, I think then.
Go ahead.
He still has to have his conviction reversed on grounds consistent with innocence. In other words, the statutory language you're citing, 590.11 sub B, B parent 1 says it means a conviction that's set aside, one, on grounds consistent with innocence, and two, no remaining felony. So you don't even get to the no remaining felony unless it's grounds consistent with innocence, which takes us back to back. And I think what the chief is asking is, you know, to the extent you're saying, well, the prosecutor's citation of 590.11 subdivision 3 means we should just assume the prosecutor is indicating prosecutor wouldn't have charged or would have dismissed. Well, isn't that assumption inconsistent with the fact that the prosecutor tried to amend to a gross misdemeanor to maintain some sort of conviction after it was reversed? I think that's what we're wondering.
Yeah. Thank you for more articulately asking my question. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's our position that for it to matter for purposes of meeting the requirements of the statute, that if there isn't a remaining felony, because that's what's important for purposes of determining whether someone's exonerated, then that language in context would refer to not pursuing a felony level charge that resulted in the kind of imprisonment that it did here, where Mr. Smith spent 43 months. So that would be our position, is that it doesn't, you know, the punishment, so to speak, of a gross misdemeanor, if one qualified, would be reducing the time of compensation, not eliminating the right to compensation. Because if the gross misdemeanor isn't going to disqualify you from being exonerated, then that would be our position, is that that's in context how that language should be interpreted.
Are there additional questions?
No.
All right. Well, we thank you first for the supplemental briefing. We appreciate your compliance with that request and for the argument this morning, clarifying your position on some things. And the matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.